victims. We are a force. We will play a major role in determining Alaska's destiny.
AFN kicks off in Anchorage with a speech from Iditarod champion John Baker. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Sitka Coast Guard member faces criminal charges for his role in a deadly helicopter crash.
You're toast if you're acquitted, you're toast if you're found guilty. So as far as your military career, it ends upon the charges.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
The Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention got underway today in Anchorage at the Dena'ina Convention Center. The event is billed as the largest annual gathering of Native people in the United States. This year's theme is Strength in Unity, and AFN President Julie Kitka stressed that message in her remarks as she talked about the importance of a unified voice as Congress's supercommittee looks to shave more than $1 trillion from the federal budget before Thanksgiving. Kitka said although funding for Native programs is a small part of the overall budget, cuts to them could be devastating to Native communities. She says this fall, it's crucial to be heard in Washington, D.C.
The time for unity across our nation among Native people is right now. The time for a progressive action plan, an agenda that's packed to accomplish all our goals, is now. Let's use our time this week not to argue, not to fight, but to come together and press forward and change the course of history.
Congressman Don Young also talked about the importance of Alaska Natives standing together. He told the attendees that Native businesses are the economic base of Alaska.
You, as a group, if you stay united, can lead this state. My hope, I would be no more prouder in my life than to have a Alaska Native be the United States Congressman.
But clearly, the crowd was most excited about welcoming this year's keynote speaker, the 2011 Iditarod champ, John Baker, who was introduced by retiring North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta. As Itta proudly spoke of Baker not only winning the Iditarod after 16 years of running it, but shattering the record by 3 hours, the crowd broke into a spontaneous honoring of John in traditional Inupiaq fashion.
A record that stood for 9 years. Adaha. So proud. Many of us in this room can remember. Aria! Ha! Aria! 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 That's for you, John. That's for John.
When Baker spoke, he talked about being born and raised in Kotzebue. He said although there are problems that confront Native people every day, he prefers to see them as challenges.
Too often when things seem difficult, there's a temptation to see ourselves as victims. I'm here to tell you today that we are only victims if we allow ourselves to be.
But Baker didn't spend as much time talking about himself or his accomplishments as he did about his mother, Marge Baker, who he called his role model. His father died when he was 6 and left John's mother with 7 children to raise. He said she never complained and raised all of her children to be independent, hardworking people, all while running her own business, Baker Aviation.
For 2 decades, she was the only woman in Alaska who owned and operated her own air taxi. She was eventually joined by her friend Rita Scholten with Northern Air Cargo, and they made aviation history while providing an important service to the people in our rural communities.
He said the morning he won the Iditarod, he found out she had cancer, but he said she still inspired her family to stay strong. He asked his mom, in the front row, to stand for applause. Baker then brought his comments back to the theme of unity and not succumbing to the victim mindset as he reminded people of the economic strength of Native businesses in Alaska.
Economists are talking about the new North and that this could be the century of the Arctic. We are seeing increased activity in our Arctic waters, and the search for oil and gas extends into the waters off our coastal communities. Mining interests are looking for minerals near our waterways. Even we may not agree on how much development and shipping traffic is acceptable, but let's make certain that it is done with our input. We have a voice, and we will use it. We are not victims.
Jacqueline Johnson-Peta, the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, spoke next, saying listening to John Baker made her proud to be Alaska Native. Johnson-Peta is Tlingit. She said NCAI is pushing three main issues with Congress. One is to make sure Indian country is held harmless in the budget cuts. The second is restoring Native lands and the ability to take land into trust. And the third is amending the Violence Against Women Act to safeguard Native women and children. Johnson-Peta said NCAI is working against the continuing attacks in Congress on Alaska Native Corporations' involvement in the 8A federal contracting program.
We continue to meet those challenges one right after another. In order to be able to say, we are a good federal investment, we do business for the federal government, we provide services and supplies to the federal government, and in doing so, we improve the livelihood of our needed communities.
She also stressed needed changes to Indian education through a draft plan called the Indian Class Act. The AFN convention continues tomorrow. The U.S. Coast Guard has brought criminal charges against the sole survivor of a 2010 helicopter crash in which three people from Air Station Sitka died. Lieutenant Lance Leone is facing possible court-martial for negligence and the death of two of his crewmates, all violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and all charges he intends to fight. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
In July of 2010, a newly refit Jayhawk helicopter was flying to Sitka from Astoria, Oregon, when it ran into some power lines strung across a channel and crashed into the water off La Push, Washington. Three of the four people on board were killed: the pilot, Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks. Co-pilot Lance Leone was injured and survived. He's now facing three charges from the Coast Guard. The first is that he negligently failed to navigate the helicopter away from charted hazards and failed to make sure it was flying above 500 feet in accordance with Coast Guard policy. The second charge is for the destruction of military property, the chopper, which was valued at $18.3 million. Both of those charges are misdemeanors. The third charge is a felony. The Coast Guard says Leone negligently caused the deaths of Hoke and Banks. There are two counts, each carrying a maximum of 3 years in jail. Leone is not facing charges in connection with the death of the helicopter's commander, Sean Kruger. The charging document amounts to what would be a criminal complaint in civilian courts. The Coast Guard intends to convene an Article 32 hearing, which is similar to a grand jury, to determine if Leone should be court-martialed.
The Article 32 hearings are not used to determine guilt or innocence.
Chief Petty Officer Kip Wadlow is a Coast Guard spokesman.
It is a review of the evidence that's been collected, along with the potential charges that are being faced by the member.
Wadlow says an investigation began immediately following the crash of Helicopter 6017. The details of that investigation have not been made public, and the Coast Guard says they won't be released until after the proceedings regarding Leone are concluded. But a former military lawyer says the damage might already have been done.
Your career can end without being court-martialed. It doesn't take much. In the military, it doesn't take much.
Lieutenant Colonel John Farr is retired now and in private practice in Anchorage, but he spent most of his career as a judge advocate general in the Army. He says in cases like this, acquittals are common, but even charges are enough to do serious harm to a military career.
You're toast if you're acquitted. You're toast if you're found guilty. So as far as your military career, it ends upon the charges in this day and age.
Leone's attorneys have asked him not to speak to the media during this phase of the process. In addition to a military-appointed lawyer, Leone is represented by Anchorage attorney Philip Widener, who did not return calls for comment. Efforts in Sitka are underway to establish a legal defense fund to help Leone with expenses. Farr says the charges against Leone are extraordinarily serious, but not unprecedented. Military accidents always involve an investigation, and often officers connected to the incident face some sort of consequence.
I mean, in addition to the tragedy of whatever happened, if a training accident happens on your watch, you know that it's going to potentially impact your career, not only your career, but the careers of everybody up the chain of command.
But Farr also says Leone's intention to fight the charges is a good move, especially in light of the felony counts.
Oh, you have to defend yourself. If you're convicted of a felony, there's a lot of disabilities involved in being a felon. You can't serve on a jury. You can't vote. Can't possess a firearm. There's a lot of reasons to not be a felon. And because that's the way our system works, he should fight it. He should definitely fight it all the way.
Wadlow, the Coast Guard spokesman, says the officer who presides over Leone's Article 32 hearing will release the findings to Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, who commands the Coast Guard district encompassing Alaska. It will be up to Ostebo whether the findings proceed to a court-martial, whether the charges are dropped, or whether the matter is handled administratively. Leone's hearing is tentatively scheduled for December. With reporting from Robert Woolsey, this is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, female carvers make history and art in Wrangell.
It's a real awakening, paying attention and appreciating what the wood is telling you. So it's just almost like a spiritual thing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
There was a big turnout in Fairbanks yesterday for a hearing on a draft management plan for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is taking feedback on the 15-year plan, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, one aspect of the proposal is getting all the attention.
The plan includes a wilderness recommendation option for the refuge's coastal plain. The 1.5 million acre plain is eyed for oil and gas development, but also prized as important for wildlife. Gwich'in Athabaskan David Solomon of Fort Yukon was first in line to express his support for wilderness status. Solomon says the refuge area is central to his people's health and culture.
It's purified. It is sacred. It is where our caribou and all the animals start off when they go down to the lower 48. People in the lower 48 don't realize that that bird up there, when they first migrate up there, when they get their little ones, they grow up and then they fly down the lower 48. So all these things are being disturbed if they try to oil develop it up there.
Solomon cites the longevity of elders he credits to a subsistence diet dependent on the health of the refuge. Pam Miller, Arctic coordinator with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center, says the refuge's coastal plain is small compared to the over 10 million acres of state land on the North Slope already open to oil development.
It's the only part of Alaska's entire North Slope that is protected by law from oil and gas development. The rest of the North Slope has an ever-expanding sprawl of industrial development. That area has had harmful impacts to wildlife and to subsistence of people, and it's ever-growing.
Miller says Department of Interior and National Academy of Sciences studies have confirmed impacts to wildlife will occur if oil development proceeds. She says that's still the case despite improved technology that's reduced the footprint of the industry. For others at the hearing, like labor union member Jim Plackey, the idea of any more wilderness in Alaska is unappealing.
It's just like Pac-Man. It seems like the federal government just wants to take more and more Alaska land, and I think Alaska has enough wilderness land already. So that's what we're here to say today, that no more wilderness destination.
Plackey was among a strong labor contingent on hand in support of opening the refuge. Local 942 business manager Tim Sharp said oil development in the refuge would result in more jobs for Alaskans.
The producers that we do have relationships with and that are smart enough to realize that if Alaskans aren't working, they're usually fighting a defensive battle for a lot of different reasons on taxation issues, on permitting, and so forth. So I think it would be common sense and an easy reach that Alaskans would be going to work if ANWR opens up.
Sharp said putting more Alaska oil on the market will also lessen demand for foreign crude. There are several steps between public hearings and a decision on the future of the Arctic Refuge's coastal plain. The Fish and Wildlife Service will release a final plan and preferred alternative in the spring. And even if it includes a recommendation for the coastal plain, Fish and Wildlife Service refuge planner Sharon Symes says that's just a first step.
The maximum that anybody within the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Department of Interior or even the President of the United States can do is potentially recommend wilderness or choose not to recommend additional wilderness. If Congress then chooses to act on a recommendation or to overturn that recommendation and open it to oil and gas, that's their prerogative.
In the meantime, Symes says the refuge management plan concerns more than the coastal plain. She says other focuses include issues related to climate change, visitor use, and wildlife-human interactions. The Fish and Wildlife Service will respond to substantive comments made at hearings around the state and online after the public input period closes November 15th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A tanker truck rolled on an icy road in Fairbanks yesterday and caused a fuel spill. Snow and freezing rain coated roads, and there were numerous accidents across the region. Ashley Anderson with the State Department of Environmental Conservation says the driver of the Alaska Aero Fuel truck lost control of the vehicle on a residential street off the Richardson Highway.
When it hit a curb, it caused the fuel in the top of the truck to kind of push to one side and caused the truck to roll. Upon the impact onto the curb, the inner tank of the fuel truck became disengaged and began releasing fuel onto the road.
Anderson says an estimated 1,500 to 2,000 gallons of heating oil spilled. She says most of the fuel went onto pavement and into roadside ditches, and a lot was cleaned up.
Using oil absorbent pads, and after the oil absorbent pads were collected, they use kind of like a giant squeegee to collect all the free product into one area where there was a vac truck there to suck up the free fluids.
Anderson says teams use sawdust to absorb any remaining fuel. She estimates responders, including a city fire crew and borough hazmat team, collected about 1,000 gallons of the spilled fuel. She says none of the oil went into storm drains, but there is concern about fuel soaking into unfrozen ground. She says any contaminated soil will be excavated and hauled out for treatment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
High school football rivalries traditionally feature teams across town from each other, but in a state as big and sparsely populated as Alaska, some unusual rivalries are bound to pop up. The Barrow-Valdez Pipeline Bowl is one example. And as the high school football season winds down, KCHU's Tony Gorman has this look back at how the contest started.
The rivalry started in 2006 when Valdez and Barrow met for the very first time. It was Barrow's first year as a team and Valdez won. But after the game, then Barrow coach Mark Voss and Valdez coach Lee Cockerham thought of a fun way to make the annual contest between the two a little more interesting.
It was like, gosh, you know, here we are at the top of the pipeline and here you guys are at the end of the pipeline, you know.
And we didn't really have any history or tradition with football that would try to create something to generate some fun and some pride with it. And so we came up with the Pipeline Bowl trophy.
To better understand the rivalry, I visited the Whalers at practice on a windy, cloudy day last month on a Smurf turf at Kathy Parker Field.
Oh,
The team had only one loss going into the Pipeline Bowl. Players like Whalers senior quarterback Eddie Benson, who has never lost the Pipeline Bowl, would like to see the trophy stay north of the Arctic Circle.
They got some good athletes. I mean, we always know they got good athletes. And then we try to come out, stick to fundamentals, and then hopefully we do what the coaches tell us, we come out with a win.
The wooden trophy was designed and constructed by Butch Failing of Valdez. The base is filled with the results from each game. Valdez won the trophy for the first 2 years of the rivalry, but Barrow has kept it for the past 4 years. If you walk through the halls of Barrow High School, you'll find a trophy in the display case with the rest of the school's accolades.
Like the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Along there.
Yeah, they did a really nice job on it. It's impressive.
Down in Valdez, the Buccaneers are having a different kind of season. Loaded with experience and high expectations, the team has only won one game. Despite a disappointing year, Cockerham says his team isn't ready to fold the tent. He says there are a lot of memories associated with the Pipeline Bowl game.
It was great for the kids who had never been to the North Slope, myself included. We won that game, and of course we got to take the polar bear plunge into the Arctic Ocean. That was fun. Got our certificates and really had a good time with it.
Some players, like Bucks senior running back and linebacker Jesse Deaton, would like to put the recent history of the Pipeline rivalry behind them and salvage a win in the series.
We definitely want it back, and the season has definitely not gone the way we planned it, so we need to go in. We definitely got to make up for it and stick it to them.
With the mentality set, both teams head into the weekend's game in Valdez with one goal in mind: the Pipeline Trophy.
NASCAR, Blue 35. Blue Louisville.
Sideline there, Jesse Deaton on the stop.
It's a muddy battle between the two. Both teams traded fumbles and penalties in the low-scoring game. It looked like Valdez might pull out a win, but in the last 4 seconds, Barrow used a hook and lateral to clinch the game for the Whalers 8-6. After the game, Cockerham was proud of his team's performance despite the result.
This is by far our best game that we played all year. I can't say enough about the team. I wouldn't trade any of them for anything.
Valdez would end its season by losing to Kodiak at home the following week. Barrow would go on to win the conference title and lose to Nikiski in the small school state championship. As for the trophy, the Bucks will have to travel to Barrow next year in another attempt to get it back. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The Wrangell Cooperative Association is moving forward on the renovation of the historic Chief Shakes Tribal House in Wrangell. And in a first for the community, three women were recently chosen as the local carvers for the project. They're all using handmade adze, a tool commonly used by Pacific Northwest Indians. KSTK's Charlotte Duran has more on the new team and how they are changing the look of adzing in Wrangell.
The renovation of Chief Shakes Tribal House in Wrangell's downtown harbor is underway. But across the harbor, in a small shed, a group of six carvers work diligently adding the new houseposts, beams, and flooring that will cover nearly 7,000 square feet of the structure. And as Chief Shakes Tribal House gets a 21st century makeover, so does its carvers. The team consists of headmaster carver Wayne Price of Haines, Vanessa Pazar of Sitka, Justin Smith of Whitehorse. And after weeks of adzing classes in August and September, the Wrangell Cooperative Association recently announced Wrangell's newest carvers for the project. They include Wrangell's very own Tammy Meisner, Susie Kasinger, and Linda Churchill. All women, which is a first in Wrangell.
I started showing up in the evenings and kind of hanging out, and then I found out that these two were coming in during the day, and I'm like, hey man, I want to come in during the day. And next thing I knew, I was right there 8 hours, volunteer for like 3 weeks.
I'd come down to the carving shed, and then I'd disappear to run back down to my shop to do a haircut or a perm, and then I'd show back up again, and I'm like, well, the reason why I'm disappearing is because I still have a job, you know, so it happened so fast. I mean, I signed up for the ads class not knowing that there was jobs available.
That's Susie Kasinger. She's a non-native local who's been interested in native culture since she was 12 years old, and over the years has been collecting carving tools to better her craft. She says once she found out jobs were being offered to qualified carvers, she knew this was an opportunity she didn't want to miss.
when am I going to get an opportunity to work with a master carver again? How many chances in my life is this going to happen? And so I just kept coming down and putting time in and showing them that I was serious. We all want to be here more than anything.
Once the three women were chosen, they spent the first 3 weeks focused on practicing the art of adzine. Tammy Meisner has lived in Wrangell her whole life and has been a longtime supporter and educator in Search Traditional Foods. Meisner says after just a few classes, she was hooked.
Once you get into a rhythm, you know, it's you become one with the ads, one with the board. It's almost like possession over you, you know, and you just don't want to stop.
She says people often ask how she can pound on a piece of wood all day. But she says there's a lot more to adzine than that.
I mean, you have to read the wood. You have to understand what it's telling you. You have to understand how you're using your ads. You have to practice. You have to take your time. And it's a real awakening, paying attention and appreciating what the wood is telling you. So it's almost like a spiritual thing.
Along with being spiritual, Meisner says the process can be physically grueling. The women work 8-hour days, sometimes 6 days a week. And at this point, the group has added over 3,000 square feet of boards for the restored house. Vanessa Pazar has been carving for over a decade in this traditionally male-dominated craft. And she says working on this project with Wayne Price and the rest of the team is something she's always wanted to do.
They're creating some beautiful artwork. I'm really proud of the artwork that we're putting up in this Klein house.
Master carver Wayne Price says the project is ahead of schedule and says he's very happy with the team that was chosen.
I think it's a wonderful new time in our life. I think it's they're going to be recognized. I think the work that they're going to do will be recognized, and I look forward to a new chapter.
The four women plan to continue working on carving projects once Chief Shake's Tribal House is done. And they say eventually they would like to be the ones teaching the next generation the craft locally. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Charlotte Duran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can check out photos there from AFN Arts and Crafts, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Charlotte Duran in Wrangell. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska. It's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.